I know that after 30-something years as a journalist, I have never come across a conspiracy theory that really stood up, ever. And when we came across this, it became pretty obvious when we did some serious level research that this wasn't a theory, that this was a conspiracy.
Ladies and gentlemen!
As we realized that this story was real, as opposed to another conspiracy theory, it was something that we had to do. We had to get it right. We're talking about, Tim, the biggest criminal gang in history. They walked through Europe, they stole every central bank's gold reserves, they raped and raided every single monastery, museum, anything they could. Told them where the treasures were. But it was also the treasure of what became Operation Paperclip. Part of that deal was, this guy never sees the light of day again. So you make sure that he's kept very quiet. So much of the information that comes out is overshadowed by what strikes me as idiocy. Stuff you can't prove. So we should go after this in a as forensic a way as we can. To tell the story of what really happened. And it's not the story we were told. Definitely not the story I was told.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. We have got an absolutely mind-bending edition of the program for you, my friends. This time on the program, we are going to examine one of the great mysteries of World War II as we welcome Gerard Williams, co-author of Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. In this expansive conversation, we are going to go in depth on the Hitler death hoax conspiracy, including why the mainstream version of Hitler's death is fundamentally flawed, how Martin Bormann played a critical role not just in Nazi Germany, but also in laying the groundwork for the escape plan years before the war ended. We'll learn about Hitler's likely journey to Argentina and his post-war life there, as well as the children fathered by Hitler, and his ultimate fate years after the war ended. Beyond those details, of course, we are going to discuss some of the more obscure and tangential elements of World War II, including the extensive plunder of European art by the Nazis, how their poor organizational skills facilitated a victory for the Allies, and how there were actually plans by high-ranking Nazis to twist the war into a unified battle, teaming with the Allies against the Russians. Altogether, it is a absolutely thrilling edition of the program, which will likely have you looking at world history in a whole new light as Gerard Williams makes the case for the escape of Adolf Hitler. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Gerard Williams, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Gerard Williams has been an international television journalist and filmmaker for over 30 years. After graduating from journalism college, he was hired by Viz News, the international TV news agency, where he spent 2 years before moving to Australia, working for ABC and Australian Associated Press, as well as being an independent radio news correspondent for 2 years. Upon his return to the UK, he rejoined Viz News, and after various jobs elsewhere in TV news, was eventually appointed deputy editor at Reuters Television. He has worked as a foreign duty editor at the BBC, Sky News, and APTN. Gerard has worked and reported in over 65 countries, and has set up and managed/edited projects as diverse as Super Channel News, European Business Today for BSB Sky, breakfast editor at European Business News, and managing editor at Africa Journal. Altogether, Gerard Williams has been responsible for hundreds of live hours of broadcast television. He has covered most of the top international news stories of the last 20 years, including the fall of the Soviet Union, the war in Yugoslavia, the Rwanda genocide, the first Gulf War, the aftermath of the second Gulf War and the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and the 2004 tsunami. He has recently made documentary films in Kenya, Argentina, and Albania, which have been broadcast by Al Jazeera International, SIC in Portugal, Channel 4 News in the UK, and Sky News. He is currently post-producing a major drama documentary, Grey Wolf, and is developing various feature film proposals. The website for the book and the film Grey Wolf can be found at www.greywolfmedia.com. Pretty simple, all one word, greywolfmedia.com. Check it out. And with all that said, let's get down to business, my friends, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on April 3rd, 2012. Gerard Williams, talking about Grey Wolf, the escape of Adolf Hitler, on BOA Audio, Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio, Season 7. And we have got a real barn burner of an episode for you, my friends. I absolutely cannot wait to dig into this one. Our guest is Gerard Williams. He's the co-author alongside Simon Dunstan of the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. And I just finished this book this morning. Folks, this is magnificent. It is absolutely amazing. It is a tour de force. I highly recommend this one. If you're looking for a summer book to pick up and read during your downtime in the next few months, go out and get Grey Wolf, because it is tremendous. I absolutely love this book. I actually had to pace myself, because as I started reading it, I was getting closer and closer to finishing it way before we were going to do the interview, because it was so engrossing. So I had to actually kind of put it down and come back to it as we got closer to the interview, because I knew I was going to fly through the rest of the book. It is just absolutely tremendous. I can't put this one over enough, and I'm just thrilled to have Gerard Williams here to talk about this really mind-blowing research that he's done and put together here with Simon Dunstan, as I said, in Grey Wolf. So welcome to the program, Gerard. I cannot wait for this conversation, my friend.
Thanks very much, Tim. That's extremely kind of you. Extremely kind of you. I'm glad you found it interesting.
Oh, interesting is an understatement. Like I said, I just could not put this thing down. It was just tremendous. Now, we usually start out with some bio, some background. You know, tell the folks at home, who is Gerard Williams? You know, and how did you and Simon sort of, find your way towards looking at this Hitler conspiracy?
Well, I've been a television journalist for coming up to 34 years now. I've held senior positions at Reuters Television, the BBC as a foreign duty editor, Sky News, run my own news production companies, been to about 65 different countries, covered the war in Yugoslavia, out of Belgrade, Serbia, the fall of the Soviet Union, the genocide in Rwanda, a couple of trips into Baghdad, post-Gulf War I and post-Gulf War II. So I've been a serious journalist for all of my life. And Simon is a military historian who's written 50-odd books. He's an expert on the fighting armored vehicle, really, but as much an expert on World War II as you could hope to find. This all started off, it's a strange story, really. I was sitting in a car park at the Al-Rashid Hotel in Baghdad in the Green Zone in 2003, wearing a flak jacket and a helmet, and I couldn't find the car that was meant to be taking me to the airport down the murder mile. So I sat down, lit a cigarette, and thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm too old. And so it sort of came on me suddenly. Little did I know that my best friend and great cameraman, Bill Stout, was feeling the same way coming out of Afghanistan with dysentery. We got together in London, Bill and I, and decided that we'd go back to doing long-form documentary programs, which we'd done a lot of together in Africa. And although he'd been to Central America, neither of us had ever been to Latin America, and so we thought we'd start with A. And Bill, unfortunately, got very ill, so I went out with another great cameraman and did a series of documentaries in Argentina on the children of the disappeared. So during the 1970s, there was a horrible, dirty war in Argentina. They killed 30,000 of their own people. And when they kidnapped or captured pregnant women, they usually allowed them to give birth before murdering them. And then their children would be handed on to members of the military or the justice, what a terrible word to use in this situation, to be brought up. So we did a long documentary on that, a piece on veterans from the Malvinas Falklands War, which we're marking the 30th anniversary of just at the moment, and another piece about the footballer, the soccer player, you'd call him Diego Maradona, mm-hmm. who's something of a legend around the world. And while I was there, we were in country for 7 weeks, and fell in love with Buenos Aires, which is an amazing city, wonderful place. And was looking around for stories to do, to come back and do. And I came across this story that is pretty well known in Argentina, that Adolf Hitler had escaped at the end of World War II and had gone to live in San Carlos de Bariloche, or very near to San Carlos de Bariloche, down near the Andes. And I thought, brilliant. I've never done a conspiracy theory story in my life. I could do with a laugh. And I'm going to look at it. And, you know, I'm going to do a silly film about a man escaping who we all thought was dead in the bunker to Argentina and living there for 17 years. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, as we got further into looking at this story and started to look at the forensic evidence or the lack of forensic evidence in the bunker, and the lies that were told, we started to realize that we were on something much more serious than a silly conspiracy theory story, but we were on something that was actually a serious conspiracy, what I think is the greatest confidence trick of the 20th century. And that's how it started out. It started out with us picking a country beginning with A in Latin America. And wanting to do a silly story because I'd done too many serious stories in my life.
There you go. Yeah. Well, the book is exciting too, in a sense, for two reasons. Kind of that you sort of elucidated here in the bio part. You know, you're a serious journalist, and I mean, with all due respect to the folks who've been on my show who are conspiracy researchers, a lot of them aren't as decorated in the world of journalism as you are. So here we have someone from outside the conspiracy realm looking at this, which is tremendous, which is what we need. And then additionally, this Hitler story, it's floated around in the conspiracy realm for a long time, but with the exception of a handful of books, I think there was one book or two that came out. Like, usually it's relegated to, maybe a paragraph somewhere, or a chapter if you're lucky, or a couple of pages in a conspiracy book. This is
They usually involve Antarctic bases.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Nazi UFOs on the moon, the Bell, and the incredible technology that the Nazis had at the end of the war, and all those things. And people immediately shy away, I think, from what I'd call the more left field approach to this incredible story. And the reality is that there's no reason to go into left field. The information that you need to find out the truth about this was all published at the time, and is all there. And there are still eyewitnesses alive today who saw him in Argentina in the 50s.
Exactly. This is like so grounded in reality that, as I said, it's just, as you get deeper into it, it's just really riveting stuff. Now, obviously,
one of the things I really need to do always when I'm on a story is I need to walk the ground. You know, you can't do this off a desk.
Yeah.
You can't do it off, well, you do a lot of it off the internet and, you know, places like the National Archives in Kew. And I've been over to America a couple of times to talk to people and look at things there. But we've been to Argentina, Simon and I, 17 times.
Wow.
So we have distinctly walked the ground. We put our time in, we've spoken to people face to face, looked at the archives in Argentina. And it's something that, you know, I felt, as we realized that this story was real, as opposed to another conspiracy theory, it was something that we had to do. We had to get it right, because, you know, putting out a book like Grey Wolf immediately opens you up after my career to a huge amount of ridicule, from your peers and everybody else. Luckily, most of my peers that I have the respect for have now read the book after calling me a nutter originally, have now read the book and have been swayed. I'm not sure they're convinced because it goes against so much accepted history, but they have distinctly been swayed and people have stopped calling me a nutter, which is a nice thing.
That's always a good thing, right?
Yes, I hope so.
Now, I guess let's sort of like dive into the book, because I took some notes as I was going along, and
sure.
There's elements in the book that are certainly, you know, tangential to the overall story that I thought were worth sort of bringing out into light as we discuss the whole book in general. And then one of the first things I thought was interesting is, like, early in the book, you talk about how there, below Hitler in the power structure of the Nazis, there was, like, always this infighting amongst Bormann and I may get some of these names wrong, so bear with me, but, you know, because there's so many different characters, but, like, Goebbels and Goering and the guy, all the, like, the, you know, the number two, number three, number four guys, they're always sort of fighting each other to be the ultimate number two, which I thought was really interesting, and you guys point out in the book that that's kind of how Hitler held on to his power, by always having these infights amongst his subordinates, and also that, you know, contrary to what people may think about the Third Reich, a lot of their government institutions, I see in the book that you say, were massively ineffective.
Yeah, a complete mess.
Yeah.
I mean, big government in the worst sort of way. I mean, some of them were horribly effective. You know, the racial part of it, the murder of 6 million Jews, was immensely effective. But a huge amount of it wasn't. And their military planning was poor in some ways. Whereas, you know, the Russians built one tank, the T-34, and it hammered its way through Nazi armor. The Germans built 30 different types of tank, and most of them specified like a modern BMW. Whereas, you know, a T-34 looked like the inside of a tin can, but it was effective. So they weren't very effective as either a political or in their military planning. I mean, you know, they were effective immediately, but they didn't last, thank God. And the whole divide and conquer thing is something, you know, that despots have used throughout history. You never let one of your subordinates get into a position of power where they could threaten you. And Hitler was quite clever about that.
Right, right. And the main guy who kind of emerges from the book as, like, the key player to this whole thing is Martin Bormann. I mean, his fingerprints are all over this book.
It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm sure to historians and people who are well-versed in, you know, the story of World War II, they're knowledgeable about this guy. But for me personally, it was like, this is sort of like one of the most under-discussed characters in history, because it really seems like he was pulling all these strings.
I mean, he's referred to as Hitler's secretary in a number of serious historical books. I mean, Bormann was much more than Hitler's secretary. Bormann was the power behind the throne. Hitler said that if he needed something done, it was Bormann who always got it done. Bormann was a criminal genius. They called him the Telex General. He never took military rank. So he didn't become a general or field marshal or, you know, Obergruppenführer of the SS or anything. He always stayed as party secretary, head of the chancery, and he never wore a flash uniform. He just stayed in the background. But as the war continued, especially from 1943 on, if you wanted to get to Hitler, you had to go through Bormann. And Bormann was also the man who had sorted out all the finances behind the Third Reich, and especially behind Hitler. Hitler was, I suppose, I'm trying to think of major sports stars in America who put their name to brands and everything else. So you'd have Magic Johnson, you'd have David Beckham here.
Yeah.
But Hitler got a percentage of every stamp that was sold in the Third Reich. He got a percentage on every book that was sold in the Third Reich. Every time his image was used, he got a percentage of that. And this was all organized by Martin Bormann, who ran his financial affairs and made Hitler a millionaire very, very quickly. And we're talking, you know, dollar millionaire in the 1930s. So this was real money. Millions aren't worth what they used to be.
Yeah.
So Martin Bormann was key to the structure of the party. He had an index, a Rolodex, on everybody of any importance. He knew exactly what their weaknesses were. He could run them. And he was the man who everybody had to funnel through to get anything done with Hitler. It was Bormann who was the key to this.
Yeah, yeah. Just tremendous stuff. I was just completely like, you know, emerges as you're going along in the book and just keeps getting more and more central to this entire plot, where it's just like, my goodness, like, you know, they should have been looking for this guy. He sounds like he was really, was kind of running a lot of the show in a lot of ways.
And the great thing is, they did look for him. I mean, Bormann and Hitler was not ever found guilty of anything. They didn't put him on trial at Nuremberg, despite the fact they didn't have his body. They had no forensics to say that he was dead. They didn't have Martin Bormann's body either, and Bormann had disappeared. But he was put on trial for crimes against humanity at Nuremberg, at the International Military Tribunal, and was found guilty and sentenced to death. But one of the most clever things about this whole, what happened at the end of the war, is how people were seen to die. People were seen to be killed. People were seen to be buried. And yet, as you look at the forensics available to you, I mean, the great example of me is the Gestapo, Obergruppenführer, the head of the Gestapo, Müller. Gestapo Müller, he was known as. He was buried by his family in Berlin in 1945, and they put up a lovely little headstone saying to our dear daddy and everything else. Well, when his body was exhumed in 1963, there were three different bodies in that coffin. Two of them were female, or bits of female bodies, and another was male. But it wasn't Heinrich Müller. It wasn't the Gestapo chief. He'd set it up. And in the same way that, you know, we propose, and we're pretty sure of, the fact that two people did die in the bunker in Berlin, but they were murdered. They didn't commit suicide. And they were lookalikes, Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. So people who saw those bodies burnt saw what they expected to see.
Yeah.
It's also the same with Martin Bormann. You know, he's supposedly dead in Berlin in 1945. And then the West Germans go on to DNA test what they say the remains they find in the 1970s are. And they prove that it's definitely Martin Bormann. But the DNA test done on Bormann in the 90s was from an 83-year-old. The comparison came from an 83-year-old unnamed relative of Martin Bormann's, despite the fact he had 6-7 children who were available for them to test directly against. And they've never named this person, the West German government. It just stinks, unfortunately. There were so many Nazis in the West German government after the war, people who'd held positions of authority under National Socialism, and they just covered this up. They covered the whole thing up, and they did it very cleverly.
Exactly. We'll get into sort of the motivations of all of the cover-up in a little bit. Now, what the other thing that in the book, another aspect of the book that was just totally elucidating and just really opened my eyes and sort of dropped my jaw is the best way to say it, was the extensive discussion in the book on the plunder of Europe that went on. I'd kind of heard about this, but never in the detail that's provided in Grey Wolf. It was just tremendous stuff. Like, talk a little bit about that plunder, because I was amazed by, you know, not just the theft of all the gold, essentially, like, throughout Europe, but also the just tremendous artwork that was taken, you know, by sheer force.
We're talking about, Tim, the biggest criminal gang in history. They walked through Europe, they stole every central bank's gold reserves, they raped and raided every single monastery, museum, anything they could. At the same time, when they sent people off to the death camps, instead of just, you know, executing people on the ground in the east, like the Einsatzgruppen did, but when they got rid of German Jewry and Austrian Jewry, they took all their belongings.
Yeah.
So they took everything from their insurances, to their shareholdings, to their houses, to their mortgages, to their art, to their gold, to their cash in the bank. They took everything. They amassed the largest fortune in history. And from 1943, Martin Bormann realized, I think, that the game was up, that they could not win militarily. That once it came out what they'd been doing in the camps and on the Eastern Front especially, that they wouldn't be able to run the brand anymore, if that makes sense to you, and they couldn't walk around wearing swastikas and in their Hugo Boss-designed uniforms with their black leather boots on. So Bormann set up a network of over 745 companies outside of Germany and managed to ship huge amounts of money out to these companies. Bormann also instructed all the major German companies, and Krupp, for instance, who built, cannons is how they started off, but they built a lot more after that, biggest metal workers in the world at one stage. They themselves set up 700 front companies around the world in neutral places like Argentina, Turkey, Syria, Switzerland, of course, and other countries where they had influence, so that would be places like Brazil and Paraguay. And, you know, today isn't the only time you can do an international money transfer. People have been doing telegraph international money transfers since the 1920s. So they managed to shift out a huge amount of wealth. I think the idea that the moving, you know, hundreds of tons of gold and paintings and things like that out of Europe is probably over-exaggerated. But they did ship and move a great deal of material out by ship from Spain especially. And we're talking about the wealth of occupied Europe.
Yeah.
A huge amount of which has still not been accounted for. At the end of World War II, I believe, and our researchers show us, that Martin Bormann, as part of the deal that he did with certain Americans to get himself, Hitler, and Müller out, he told them where the treasures were. And it wasn't just the treasures, for instance, in the Merkers mine, where there were everything from Rembrandts to Van Goghs to, you know, Roman statues to gold, jewels, crown jewels, everything else. But it was also the treasure of what became Operation Paperclip. People like Wernher von Braun, the man behind the V-1 and V-2 rockets, who was taken to America along with 120 of his colleagues and effectively put the United States into space and on the moon.
Yeah.
Now, Wernher von Braun's a great example of how people can be changed. The man was a colonel in the SS, which was removed from his files so that he could become a naturalized American. He was an early Nazi Party member. He was responsible for the deaths of 8,000 civilians in Britain with his V-1 and V-2 rockets. But more importantly, he was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of slave laborers in the factories in Germany that produced those weapons.
Yeah.
This man went on to be lauded by the United States. You know, he became a great American. His history was forgotten. And how can you forget that? How can that be done? But he was a treasure. He was part of the loot that was done as the deal to enable Martin Bormann to take his part of the treasure out of Europe at the end of the war and continue his plans to rebuild Germany.
Right, right, exactly, yeah. And you talk about the, you know, like I was saying, you know, it's just jaw-dropping when you think about the plunder. There's a picture on page 61 in the book that's just like, it looks like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's just
yes,
like
it
all of these sacks of treasure hidden underground that they've discovered. And it's like, at first, looking at it, and I thought they were body bags. And then I read the thing, and I was like, no, that's treasure. Like, this is insane. So
an amazing amount. You know, so much disappeared. The whole Amber Room from Leningrad disappeared completely, which was a treasure, you know, a whole room made out of amber for the Tsars.
Yeah, I've heard about that. They've never found that, right?
No, they've never found that. Goodness knows where it is, whether it was destroyed or whatever. But it's just one big example of the amount of material that they stole and took back to Germany. You know, you hear stories all the time that there are still huge caches of material buried at the bottom of Lake Toplitz or in secret bunkers somewhere in the Bavarian Alps. Who knows if they're true or not? But what is true is that it was the largest theft in history, and most of it hasn't been recovered.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll, I was just completely, I guess, amused almost in a way at the way Hitler would have them take all these paintings and like the artists that he didn't respect or didn't like, he would throw out and you know, would discard. And some of the stuff was like paintings that ended up being worth like millions and millions of dollars.
He didn't like Picasso or Modigliani or any of the, or Kaminsky, any of the sort of modern greats. That didn't suit the little painter from Austria.
Yeah.
It wasn't his idea of art. His idea of great art would have been Rembrandt and Wagner and things that probably don't have a huge market today, although you can still not buy a Rembrandt. They're too expensive.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's an example like in the book where they sold one of them for like $4,000 or something like that, and then it ended up selling like in the 90s for like $43 million or something crazy like that.
Yes, yes.
It was quite,
I wouldn't say they were great art critics.
Exactly. You know, as we're sort of going along here in the war and sort of setting the stage for you know, the ultimate conspiracy, I also found it interesting, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but it's worth, I guess, bringing back around, too, is just beyond the government aspect of the Third Reich, just how inept the military spending and the research seemed to be, because you point out in the book that they spent, it's estimated, $2 billion for the development of the V-2 rocket, which is what the United States spent on the Manhattan Project, and
yes.
there was all this concern in the U.S., about how far along the Nazis were with developing nuclear weapons, and then later it was kind of found out that much to, the way Hitler ran things, they had numerous agencies trying to develop a nuclear bomb, including the Postal Service, it seemed. Which is insane.
One of the major mistakes, thank goodness, was to dismiss so much of it as Jewish science.
Yeah.
And, when you think of Einstein, you cannot dismiss them as just Jewish science. So, they made a huge mistake, a huge error, although they were close. I think we should realize that. They just weren't as close as we were, and they had more uranium than we had, but they didn't know how to use it. And that was, despite all this money that they spent on trying to do things, it was so uncoordinated that they didn't get off the ground. And
yeah.
Thank goodness they didn't.
I know, that's the feeling I got, reading the section here about the war. It's like, it seems like, the Western world was tremendously lucky that they were so inept, because if they hadn't been so, disorganized and so, careless with the way they ran the war, it could have been a completely different outcome.
Completely, but I think, that the whole point of this is that it was run by a bunch of thugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of thugs and thieves. And while they were busy feathering their own nests, Goering would become either marshal of the forests and of hunting, and he would take a license off everybody if they wanted to hunt in the German forests. He built himself, a huge art collection from stolen stuff, had wild parties, was a big user of cocaine. Himmler was off searching for the Holy Grail and the spear of destiny and all these things. So we're not dealing with sane people at the top. But we are dealing with some people at the top, including Martin Bormann, and I think Heinrich Müller as well, who is central to this story, who realized that these people were just not going to make it. They weren't going to end up working out. And so they worked out another way of working.
Exactly, yeah. Well, they it seems like Bormann was, he was interested in Bormann first before he was interested in sort of, the cause, if you will.
He strikes me as a strange mix. I think he was intensely loyal to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
He may not have believed everything that Hitler said, but he was intensely loyal to him. And I think that loyalty went, as far as to arrange his escape. But Bormann wasn't just interested in Bormann. I think Bormann was much more interested in the continuation of Germany as a major power.
Yeah.
And he recognized that it could never be a Nazi state, but that, there was an opportunity to come back after the war, and maybe he thought he could come back. Maybe he felt he wasn't as soiled as the other members of the senior Nazis, but of course, they all were.
Yeah, absolutely. It was It's just tremendous stuff, mind-boggling as you get into it. And the other part about the war that I thought was interesting, in contrasting the ineptitude of the German side, the Allies, it seemed like there was a tremendous amount of precision involved there. I was especially intrigued by the number of specialist units that were involved on the Allies side. Yet you talk about a lot of them in the book, like the Monument Men, the group of experts who were tasked with sort of going along with the ground troops to secure and find all the artwork and key monuments and stuff, as well as Fleming's Advanced Intelligence Unit, the Red Indians, and nuclear
research. Just amazing. I mean, you can see why those spy stories and James Bond stories came out of the post-war. It's because a lot of the stuff they actually did was so strange it sounded like fiction. But in fact, it was real. I mean, Fleming is an amazing character, the creator of James Bond, the writer of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and the man responsible for going in and collecting an amazing amount of technology, which, funnily enough, ended up with the Americans, not with the British. But these people ranged ahead of Allied forces. They seemed to know where everything important was, which I find very interesting. It's as if they were being told by somebody inside the Third Reich, you need to come here, you need to pick this up, you need to get this before the Russians come.
Yeah.
And, a lot of these missions were targeted. They weren't just thought of. I mean, some of that will be down to us breaking Ultra, breaking the code network. But it can't all be down to us breaking Ultra. We must have been told. We must have been given a shopping list by somebody inside.
Right, right. Well, throughout the discussion of the war in the book, it is sort of it comes up again and again that there were members of the Nazi Party and you know, people in power in Germany who seemed like they wanted to do a flip on the war and end up teaming with the Allies to go after the Russians, which is you know, insane as it sounds. You can almost see it.
I mean, I think certain members, including Himmler, believed it up until, you know, the final days. I mean, Himmler was worried in the last days in the bunker whether he should greet General Eisenhower with the Hitler salute or offer him his hand to shake, because he thought that the Allies couldn't run a conquered Germany without his SS in place. So, I mean, a huge amount of delusion that, you know, felt that the Asian hordes, as they described the Russians, were coming to sweep through Europe, and that it would be a Christian crusade led by Germany and America and Britain that would join up, even in the final days of World War II, and turn on the Russians. Thank goodness it didn't happen in the way that they wanted it to happen. But, I mean, it was a completely idiotic idea that far down into the war that we could have become allies with them against the Russians.
Yeah,
but they still believe it.
yeah. There's so much going on under the surface of the war that I found out reading the book that I was just like, what is, you know, there's so much more to this story than what you see on TV and everything. It's amazing.
I think the thing that's annoyed me most, Tim, and I am sort of an angry middle-aged man, maybe a bit older than middle-aged now, good grief, but I'm angry that it's not the end of the war that we were told. You know, even if you take away Hitler and Bormann escaping, the end of the war that we were told was that we beat Germany, we won, we all came home set for heroes in Britain, and your guys, you know, had to go and face the Pacific, but thank goodness that didn't last. And we won. And, you know, we destroyed this evil of Nazism. It's not strictly true. That's the problem. It's not strictly true in any way, shape, or form. There are so many examples of how corporate America, what two presidents later went on to describe as the military-industrial complex, worked with the Nazis all the way through World War II.
Right.
Which is something I find disgusting. You know, major firms like Ford, who manufactured a third of the trucks that took Nazi troops to the front to kill our boys. ITT, who owned 22% of Fokker Wulf, which produced aircraft, fighter aircraft, which went after the bomber armadas over Europe. IBM, which micromanaged with offices at Auschwitz and Dachau the computational side of the Holocaust. I mean, these are three major American companies, and they've been involved in Nazi Germany since the early 1930s. They stayed involved in Germany after the war. I mean, what has fascinated me, and we're finding out more material every day as we head into our second book, is that both Ford and ITT took the American government to court at the end of World War II because American planes had bombed their factories in Germany. Well, they bombed their factories in Germany accidentally. They were actually off the bombing lists, which is another part of the war that we don't know. It's never been really made public. But the Ford plants and ITT's Fokker Wulf plants, both supplying major amounts of material for the Nazi war effort, were off the bombing list. They were both bombed accidentally at the end of the war by American bomber groups. And ITT and Ford took the American government to court, and they got tens of millions of dollars in reparations from them.
Oh, my goodness. It's scary, you know? It's like, you think that...
Why would that happen?
Yeah, it's...
And could somebody explain that to me? I'm just shocked.
It's almost like World War II signified almost the end of nationalism and a move toward this sort of, like, corporate world we're in now. It's like, these corporations have no national pride or national allegiance.
No, they don't. They're just interested in making money.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't come through as strongly in Grey Wolf. It will come through much more strongly in our follow-up book, which we're working on at the moment, is just how important these corporations were, just how important the military-industrial complex was, and how these people, with the help of people like Alan Dulles of the CIA, John J. McCloy of the World Bank and the governor in Germany, Eleanor Lansing Dulles, all people I think are central to this this conspiracy, how they ignored the wishes of the American people, how they ignored the wishes of their own presidents, and carried on and did what the hell they liked.
Exactly.
And that's wrong.
It certainly is.
In a democracy, it's wrong.
All right, so we've kind of established sort of what was going on here in the war, and I guess we should really get into the escape, if you will. So I guess talk about sort of what set the stage for that, which was, I guess, Operation Eagle Flight and Operation Fuhrland, which was all organized by Bormann. He sort of, as you and Simon explained in the book, you know, this was the groundwork. It wasn't just like Hitler, like, up and left Germany out of nowhere. Like, this was all laid out well in advance how it was all going to go down.
And it was laid out with lots of different possibilities, multiple possibilities, so that Bormann knew and Müller knew, and because these guys are administrators and they're not stupid, they knew that various things would not become available. And as it got later and later, with the Russians knocking on the door in Berlin very loudly, their escape routes became fewer and fewer that they could get them out of it. I mean, the thing that has amazed me, Tim, is that we haven't made any of this up. You know, Time magazine reported that the Russians found a secret tunnel from the Chancery building, not from the bunker, completely different place, but from Hitler's private quarters in the Chancery building. And the Russians said that they found a deeper bunker, and from that bunker led an escape tunnel to the U-Bahn, the underground system in Berlin, which is still there today. And they found in this bunker enough food, water, ammunition, and clothing to last, I think, 12 people 2 weeks or something.
Oh, wow.
It was hidden behind a panel that had been moved and in the Chancery building when they took it. There are BBC reports of embedded BBC reporter with the Russians as they arrive at the bunker, and they don't find Hitler's body or Eva Braun's body. In fact, they probably aren't even looking for Eva Braun because nobody knows that she's Hitler's mistress, apart from some very close personal friends who they knew as the Mountain People. They were handed 6 lookalikes of Hitler when they got to the bunker area. And after a while, they dismissed them. They dismissed one because he had darned socks. He had repaired socks, and they thought, well, you know, the Führer of Nazi Germany wouldn't be wearing repaired socks. And then you have all these stories that people like Hannah Reich flew him out in a helicopter and all this stuff that's been made up over the years. But we found a 1947 court report from Warsaw of a German pilot, Captain Peter Baumgart, who was actually a British citizen, ridiculously, from South Africa, but from German stock, and had come back, like many of the overseas Volksdeutsche did, to serve in Nazi Germany. And he'd been an experienced pilot during World War II, and his mission was to get into Berlin and fly Hitler, Eva Braun, Eva Braun's sister, General Hermann Fegelein, and another German general out.
And the dog.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he would have taken Blondie with him. this animal meant more to him than pretty much anybody else in the world, apart from probably Eva Braun. He managed to fly into the Hohenzollern-Damm, which is this big road right next to an underground station, which links to the underground station where the secret bunker exit came down. And in his court testimony, he describes how he got in, how he got out, how he flew them to Denmark. When the Polish judges first heard the testimony, they said, "You're mad," and sent him away for psychiatric testing. And all this was reported by Reuters and the Associated Press. 6 months later, he came back and he gave the same story with further details, and 3 eminent Polish psychiatrists said, well, he's not insane, and we don't think he's lying. But although this was reported at the time, it was never followed up, and I find that amazing. And it was never followed up because, again, we come back to, I believe, Gestapo Müller's great plan of, hey, if you're dead, nobody looks for you.
Right. That's the brilliance of the plan in a way too. I'm sure this is all kind of speculative, but like, was it always the plan for Hitler to get out of there if things got when defeat was?
No, I think he was meant to get out much earlier. And this was the last the last shot, really, the last opportunity to get out. And, you know, it's late. We're talking April 29th, so it's late. But what's interesting for us, and as part of the research, which is in the book, you know, we explain how we took pictures of Hitler to the leading facial recognition expert in London, who works for the Metropolitan Police. He was heavily involved in the facial recognition stuff from the CCTV of the bombers who did the 7/7 attacks in London.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he's a very senior man. And we had a number of pictures that have been floating around of supposedly Hitler after the war, which would be the great smoking gun. And he said, no, it's not Hitler. But we sent him some pictures for comparison, and he looked at the last pictures of Hitler taken on April the 20th, 1945. And it's quite famous. It's Hitler handing out medals to children who have been destroying tanks with Panzerfausts. And he's there with the leader of the Hitler Youth, Arthur Axman. And Professor Lenny came back and said, oh, yeah, that's not Hitler either. So I went back to him. I said, Professor, these are the last pictures of Adolf Hitler. He said, well, it's not Adolf Hitler. I checked and double-checked and double-checked. So on April the 20th, 1945, Adolf Hitler's double was being used in Germany for public appearances. And I think Bormann had this lined up from about that date to make sure that this man was present at places Hitler was meant to be seen at. And he could not persuade Hitler to get out before the 29th. Hitler was still hoping for some wonder.
Right.
You know, wonder weapon of some sort. Was still hoping that his troops would you know, continue to fight in the field. And I think they were just all too tired then.
Right. I think you make the point in the book, too, that at the time of the escape, there was like a two-day window when it was going to be possible to get it done. And after that, it was probably not going to be able to happen to get him out.
Yeah, after that, it was going to be too late.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Bormann and Müller waited until May the 1st. But they weren't... I mean, there are many pictures of Martin Bormann from the Third Reich, but not as many pictures as there are of Goering or Himmler or Goebbels or Adolf Hitler. And many of them don't identify Bormann. So he wasn't seen as a key person, so he could probably blend into the background. And Müller had organized, you know, a way out for both of them. But they didn't fly out. They had to be there in Berlin to make sure that the story would be believed.
Ah, I see. Okay. Well, because now we're kind of at a schism in a sense, where we have the story that you guys are telling, and then we have sort of like the official story. Let's talk a little bit about the official story, because for most people it ends in that bunker. You know,
yep.
As far as the mainstream historians are concerned, it does end in that bunker. So I guess...
And all that comes from is the report of one man, Hugh Trevor Roper, who was appointed by the head of MI6 in Great Britain to go in and tell the story of the last days of Adolf Hitler. Trevor Roper is an interesting choice. He was a medieval historian, I think, who had specialized in Thomas Cranmer, one of our bishops from the medieval time here, and had worked in reading intercepted cables from Germany during World War II for MI6 or MI5. He had no detective experience, no forensic experience, nothing. And yet he was chosen as the man when we could have sent Scotland Yard in, we could have sent CIC in from your side, we could have sent military intelligence in. Any group of MPs with any experience would have been able to go in and do this.
Yeah.
But we sent this guy in, and he wrote this polemic, The Last Days of Hitler, which in many ways is a great book. It really nails the myth of Nazism, and it destroys Nazism as a political culture and everything else. But Trevor Roper didn't actually do any investigation. He said that he'd interviewed Hannah Reich, who was Hitler's pilot and one of the last people to fly in, known historically, to Berlin with her then boyfriend, who became head of the Luftwaffe when Hitler dumped Goering. Trevor Roper said he'd interviewed Hannah Reich. Hannah Reich said she'd never even met him. And after the war, she said, you know, what he said, I never said. Trevor Roper also said he interviewed the Luftwaffe adjutant, the Air Force adjutant, Hitler's adjutant in the bunker. And that guy, whose name escapes me for the moment, said, yes, he was interviewed by Trevor Roper, but he liked him. And every time he read the book, he used to laugh at Trevor Roper repeating his lies. Now, this wasn't anywhere near a thorough investigation. The Russians admitted they'd found no body. Interestingly, they did find Goebbels' body and the Magda Goebbels' body. They'd committed suicide in the bunker on the Chancery grounds, and their bodies were partially burned. They were put on display alongside the Goebbels' six children who they had murdered so they wouldn't survive into a non-Nazi Germany. But they found no body that was Hitler. And, you know, Stalin said, well, we haven't found him. He's escaped to Spain or Argentina. Marshal Zhukov, who was running the Russian forces in Berlin at the time, said he could have escaped. There was an airfield at his disposal. We have found no body that could be Hitler. And yet, for some reason, I find this amazing, this medieval historian with no experience at all of anything like this before is sent in to write a report for British intelligence, and that report is accepted as gospel. The book has never been out of print. Hugh Trevor was an amazingly arrogant man, and the man who would later go on to identify the Hitler diaries in the 1980s as real. Well, they weren't. They were written in Biro, which wasn't even around in 1941, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And he got it completely wrong. He also got the deaths of Hitler wrong. He may well have just been fooled by Müller and Bormann's plan to have the lookalikes executed and possibly burnt in the garden above the bunker. But those bodies were never found.
Even the lookalike bodies weren't found.
No, the burnt bodies of Hitler and Eva were never found. The Russians at one stage said they had found it, and they got parts of his skull and parts of his jaw, and they kept them in a shoebox in Moscow for years. But an American scientist working for, I think, the History Channel Discovery,
yeah,
went in and DNA tested those. So I think it's 3 years ago now. And the DNA tests were carried out back in the United States, and it turns out that the Hitler skull is that of a woman under 40. It's not even male.
Now, do you think that you sort of put forward the idea that there was like a covert deal involved here between, you know, Bormann and the government of the U.S. government, the Allies, if you will, maybe?
No, I don't think it was the government. I mean, it's quite important to separate this out. I think that U.S. intelligence under Alan Dulles, who had been a corporate lawyer, who had been with Martin Bormann in the 1930s in Berlin, as had John J. McCloy, who becomes an important character in the new book. McCloy had actually sat in the same box as Adolf Hitler at Berlin in the Olympics in 1936. These people represented everybody from Standard Oil right through IBM, through Ford, through ITT, all the people who had Chase Manhattan Bank, all the people who had huge business in Nazi Germany.
Okay.
It was those people, this small grouping of very wealthy, very powerful industrialists and intelligence operatives who did the deal. I cannot believe, maybe I just don't want to believe, that Truman would have been involved in something like this, or that Eisenhower knew post-war. I just don't see that it's the American government as such. I think it would have been impossible to keep it as secret as it has been kept. But I do think that people like Alan Dulles and his brother, Alan Dulles and John Dulles, were immensely involved in this. They knew Bormann, they knew the Nazi Party, they knew all the industrialists, Krupp, Tussin, Siemens, all the other major German companies. And they had a good reason for Germany not being completely destroyed. I mean, there was a plan. Secretary of State Morgenthau wanted to turn Germany back into an agricultural economy.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically he was going to treat it like, well, not as badly as Rome treated Carthage, where they killed everybody over three and salted the fields, but he was going to turn it back into a country that could never, ever be a major economy again and never, ever be a threat again. He'd had enough. And, of course, that didn't happen. The Morgenthau Plan was dropped, and by 1950, German factories were producing steel to go on tanks in the Korean War for the United States.
Well, then that raises the question, I guess, that so you've established here that it's sort of these nefarious intelligence folks who really have probably more allegiance to money and corporate interests than their own countries, who kind of worked out this surreptitious deal. So why do you think that you know, the British and the U.S. government just accepted that Hitler was dead? Was it sort of like where they, you know, it wasn't worth chasing him all the way to Argentina and expanding his wars, the time just to end it kind of thing, where it's like out of sight, out of mind?
Much simpler think he was dead, I think, for everybody. I mean, Britain was completely destroyed by World War II. And, you know, under American instructions for the good of democracy, we gave away our empire at the end of World War II as well. There was still rationing here until the late 1940s, you have to remember. People wanted it to be over. We'd been in it a long time, been in it, you know, 2 years longer than you guys were. And we'd been in it a long time, and I think we just wanted to draw, as a government, as a people, wanted to draw a line in the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, also the second time we'd fought Germany in less than 40 years. So they wanted it to be over, and that was the simplest way. And I think that that's what Trevor Roper was meant to do, meant to draw a line under this now. We need to move on. And that's what he effectively did.
And it was sort of, you know, the idea that these guys, they've been shunted to exile. It's you know, they're kind of powerless now. They don't have vast armies at their disposal. It's you know.
Well, I don't think anybody knew. You know, very few people knew. And you know, the fact that they were in exile, in a place that had been prepared for them since the 1930s. I mean, Argentina, although it's a wonderful country today, in the 1930s, it was the only place outside of Nazi Germany that had its own Nazi party, with a swastika and surrounded by a cogged wheel. I've got amazing footage from the Department of Defense, your Department of Defense, from 1938, when the Anschluss happened, when Austria and Germany were merged into the new Greater Reich. And there are 30,000 Nazis in Buenos Aires at Luna Park celebrating this. It looks like a Nuremberg rally. We know from captured documents that were found after the war that Juan Perón and Eva Perón had both been in the pay of German military intelligence since 1941. The Nazis funded the coup in 1943 that brought the colonels and then Perón to power. I mean, they'd set it up brilliantly. So although they went into exile and they didn't have all their troops left or their weapons left, they had a base they could work from. And Bormann realized very soon, I think, definitely by 1952, that the way ahead was to become an economic power.
Right.
Not to have people marching behind flags. That was never going to sell again. You know, it's simply never going to sell.
Yeah. All right. So that, and then it's, I guess it goes, you know, from the government down just to the people. They just, you know, as long as they're told Hitler's dead, they're, you know, they can get over it. They don't really, you know, they're tired of this war and everything else.
I think so. I mean, it's quite interesting. There are pretty substantial FBI files on the hunt for Hitler. And I think that Director Hoover, for all his foibles and individuality characteristics, I don't think Hoover believed it. In fact, I'm pretty sure Hoover didn't believe it. But, you know, the FBI was moved out of foreign operations in the 50s. They had the Un-American Activities Committee to worry about, and all the communist spies and threats in America at that time, real or alleged. And CIA took over operations overseas.
Yeah.
And, of course, we all know who ran the CIA at that time.
Exactly. So it all comes back around to how this all was made possible. So that's sort of like the official story here, and it's been accepted ever since, which is really kind of sad and just troubling that, you know, this turn of history, this incorrect turn of history very likely is still believed by 90% or more of...
I'd say 99%.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that's amazed me, Tim, as we've gone through this, is so much of this was reported at the time by proper journalists, you know, by Reuters and Associated Press journalists, by United Press International journalists, by good writers, by extremely good writers writing for everybody from the New Yorker to the Chicago Sun Herald. And yet all that seems to have been swept away by historians who I think generally are quite lazy people. I hate to say this. But once it's been accepted that something like Trevor Roper's book is monumental, is the source text to go by, you suddenly have them treating this as if it was the Bible or the Quran. It cannot be wrong. It should not even be questioned. And that's amazed me, is, you know, the number of attacks I've had on me, not physical, but, you know, number of attacks I've had and Simon has had for even daring to revise this history, to look at it and to report what we found out, has been amazing. How dare we say that the German government would lie to us? I mean, for me, I'm sorry, as a journalist, I know governments lie all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think Iraq is my favorite lately, weapons of mass destruction. What weapons of mass destruction?
Exactly.
You know, they weren't there. And, you know, that's not the only time. In our country, we have, you know, a thing called Bloody Sunday, when 13 people were shot dead in Northern Ireland back in 1969. All were said to be IRA gunmen. And they were shot dead by paratroopers on the streets, trying to, you know, quell civil unrest at the time for terrible religious reasons. Well, 40-something years on, the report on Bloody Sunday's come out. There was no trace of any of those people carrying weapons. None. In fact, none of them did carry weapons that day, and none of them were members of the IRA. They were all civilians shot dead by our paratroopers. It's taken 45 years for that to come out. And that's one incident in Belfast, Londonderry, I think, in one town in Britain. And they managed to cover it up for years and years.
Yeah. Okay, so like I said, that's the mainstream version of what happened with Hitler. But as explained in Grey Wolf, there is very, very likely a more true story, or very likely a different story of what happened to Hitler, and that's Operation Fuhrland, which is to get him out of Germany and get him to Argentina, which is a tremendous, as you said, as you explained here, a tremendously pro-Nazi country. They're very
at the time, and very German. I mean, they had a huge German community there, and it had been bought, and paid for by Martin Bormann and his representative there, Ludwig Freuder. They had a bolt hole to which, after the war, more than 30,000 people went to. And Perón issued 10,000 passports.
My goodness.
All real Argentine passports issued to Nazis and people fleeing Europe. We're not talking a couple of hundred escaping. We're talking 30,000 escaping. And these aren't just Germans. They're, you know, Croat Nazis and Belgian Nazis and Swedish Nazis and French Nazis. But they're mainly German Nazis. And some of them, incredibly senior SS generals and Waffen-SS generals and concentration camp doctors, the evil ones that people can get a handle on, you know, like Mengele, this mad psychopathic experimenting murderer.
Yeah.
But it's the people who were mid-level, you know, colonels and lieutenant generals and people like that, important figures in all the Reich ministries, who made it out to Argentina. Not all of them stayed there. A huge number of them went back to Germany. They'd taken off their uniform, they put on a suit, and they went back to doing what they did before the war.
Unbelievable. Well, I guess detail...
I wish it was, Tim. I wish it was unbelievable. I wish we didn't have the facts available to us.
Absolutely, yeah.
Available to us.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't mean that in a pejorative way, believe me.
No, I appreciate that. But, I mean, Tim, this was my first reaction when we came across all this.
Yeah.
But it was unbelievable.
Crazy, yeah. Well, detail Hitler's journey from Berlin to Argentina, because it's not as simple as he got on a plane and flew right to Argentina. I mean, there's a tremendously harrowing trip inside of a submarine that I don't think I could do. So, I mean,
I'm with you there. The way we're pretty sure it happened is that on the evening of the 29th of April 1945, Hitler and a small group left the bunker, made it to the Chancellery, to his personal quarters in the Chancellery, where they used the escape tunnel down to the underground system, the U-Bahn system in Berlin. They then walked for about 4 or 5 miles, I suppose, 5-6 kilometers, to another underground station at Fährberlinerplatz, where they came to the surface. Waiting for them at the surface, and this is at night, it was a Ju-52, they called the Iron Annie. The classic transport plane of the Nazis, three engines, you see them in most sort of Nazi war films, very much like the DC-3, the Dakota. It was that ubiquitous. That plane, captained by Captain Peter Baumgart, flew them from Berlin to the former Zeppelin base in Denmark, the former Imperial German Zeppelin base in Denmark at Tondre, where they were seen by other witnesses. Bandat left them there, and another aircraft picked them up. We believe from one of Hitler's pilots who wrote after the war a very cryptic diary note that people would not believe if they heard what he really had to say, that they were then flown to Travemünde on the coast, where they picked up a longer-range aircraft. The Ju-52 wouldn't do much more than sort of 600-700 miles, but they managed to pick up a Ju-252. We know this aircraft was available to them at Travemünde at the end of the war. The Ju-252 flew them to Spain across Allied-occupied Europe. And everybody goes, well, you know, there were air defenses and everything else, and that they couldn't have got out. Well, quite a few people actually did get out in the final days of the war, before VE Day on May the 8th, including Leon de Grel, who flew a much less range bomber, was flown in a much less range bomber, a Heinkel HE-111, to San Sebastian in Spain. And we have numerous other reports of aircraft making it out of Nazi Germany into Spain at the time. They landed 80 miles southwest of Barcelona at an airfield called Royst, which was controlled by the Spanish government. We have to remember that Spain at this stage was under Generalissimo Franco. Franco was a fascist. Hitler and the Nazis had supported him during the Spanish Civil War and had effectively put him in power. The Spaniards sent a division called the Blue Division to fight with the Nazis at Stalingrad. And there were numerous members of the Waffen-SS who were Spanish as well. This was a time when people believed in ideologies like fascism and communism, and people believed in democracy as well. At Royst in south of Barcelona, that aircraft that had taken them there was taken apart, dismantled, and destroyed. So there could be no evidence that they'd been there. And all this was reported in the Daily Express in 1945 at the time, under an article called, Is Franco Hiding Hitler? So, you know, not new material, but we have it from other interesting sources as well. We then believe that a Ju-52, again, the Dakota of its time in fascist Europe, in Spanish colors of the Spanish Air Force, picked them up and flew them down to the Canary island of Fuerteventura. Beyond Fuerteventura, interesting place, basically run by a man called Gustav Winter, who was the senior Abwehr military intelligence, German military intelligence operative in the Canaries at that time. Built an amazing mansion and roads and everything else using political prisoners. In fact, the road to his house is still called the Way of the Prisoners. And built an airfield at the bottom of the island. And you can actually go on Google Earth and look at the bottom of Fuerteventura, and you will see the airfield, which is still there, still exists. Built in 1943 as part of the whole potential escape scenario. At the same time, there were three U-boats as part of a pack, that the final pack, Wolf Pack, that was going after shipping on the American coast. Now, this is an interesting Wolf Pack. One, it's called Sea Wolf. And almost everything to do with Adolf Hitler. I mean, the reason the book is called Grey Wolf. How's the word wolf floating around it somewhere? These three boats peeled off from that pack and got to Fuerteventura and very basically picked Adolf Hitler, Hermann Fegelein, Eva Braun up on one of the ships, two of the ships, and then made a 53-day crossing by snorkel. At this stage of the war, the Germans were very adept in the use of the snorkel, which enabled them to remain submerged but run the engines at the time. And 53 days later, they landed on the coast of Argentina, very near a German settlement called Villa Gesell, or Villa Gesell, at a place called Necochea. Now, history tells us that two of the submarines involved in this escape were sunk by U.S. naval forces at the time. In the Atlantic, just south of the Azores. But nothing came to the surface. No debris came to the surface, nothing. And so these ships are just missing. They're definitely not sunk. All the other ships, the submarines that were sunk by the U.S. Navy, all had debris fields come to the surface and everything else. And in fact, even the Royal Navy, the British Admiralty, described them as the reports of the sinking of these U-boats as some of the dodgiest reports of sinkings in the whole of World War II. Huh. But it was the end of the war, and everybody wanted a medal. So, they got away with things that you'd never get away with normally in combat. So I think a massively unpleasant experience to travel across the Atlantic in a U-boat. But the great thing was the whole point of Operation Seawolf was to draw the American forces up from the South Atlantic to protect the eastern seaboard.
Yeah.
The propaganda message went out that these submarines were carrying V-1 rockets with nerve gas probably on board them. And this was all reported in the U.S. press as being true, that U-boats were coming to the eastern coast and they were going to drop rockets full of robots, they called them, robot rockets full of poison gas on New York. And in response to this supposed threat, which actually wasn't true, you couldn't get a V-1 on a U-boat until much later. The Americans managed to do it. So they pulled up the whole of the fleet to protect the eastern seaboard, giving the submarines free rein in the South Atlantic straight across. There was nothing there even looking for them. Again, it's this great thing, you know. They're sunk. Well, two of them are sunk. The other one actually did surrender off the coast of Argentina later on. U-530 and U-977, two submarines that really made it, really were reported by the press to have made it to Argentina post-war. What they don't mention is the other two.
Right.
And it's the other two that we have police and Coast Guard reports from Argentina at the time, which show that these submarines arrived off the coast, that passengers disembarked, and were met by Nazi sympathizers. A very short while later, we have reports of Hitler at a ranch called San Ramon, which is owned by the Chambord-Gleap family, which are German ambassador of Chile. The Nazi ambassador of Chile owned the property. And we have eyewitness reports from that property in 1945 of him and Ava being there.
Who are you calling?
The press. This is big news. Sound barrier's finally been broken.
No, sir. No press.
What?
No word of this is to go beyond the flight line.
What's going on here? This is big news. We need coverage of this.
No, sir. Sorry. No press. Those are orders. National security.
But the war's over.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Well, look, pal, maybe they don't want someone to know.
Who?
The Russians, maybe.
The Russians? They're our allies.
Well, anyway, someone figured it out that way, and that's the way it is.